The one who was burned?
He asked, suddenly serious. Not quite what I thought he was about to say, but I nodded slowly. Once, when we initially got word she was missing.
He tugged a square of fabric from an inner pocket of his coat. Anything familiar about it?
My blood seemed to freeze as I took in the rich scarlet. I recalled the beautiful dress that had been discarded on Miss Crenshaw's floor. I hadn't inspected it closely, but I had been near certain it hadn't been cut up. Where did you get this?
It was left in my cabin 2 nights ago. No note, no reason why.
He took it back, folded it, and secured it into his coat once more.
I thought an attendant must have dropped it while cleaning my room, but now I'm not sure.
From a second pocket he flourished another bit of red fabric. This one had spots of rust. Blood.
Same silk. This was delivered last night.
It appears to be the same silk from Miss Crenshaw.
Appears to be?
Mephistopheles huffed.
Why not say with confidence that it is fabric from her dress? I might play at sleight of hand, but you, Miss Wadsworth, are quite adept at sleight of word.
As a scientist, it's imprudent to say something with certainty when I cannot be sure from first glance, I said coolly. Therefore, it appears to be the same fabric. Unless I had her dress to inspect, I cannot say with absolute authority it is the same. Similar, definitely. Exact?
I lifted a shoulder. A muscle in his jaw ticked.
Be annoyed as much as you will, but memory is an even better illusion worker than yourself. What of your notions regarding trick the eyes, convince the mind? Isn't that the same concept at work?
Fine. Will you accompany to Miss Crenshaw's cabin?
He asked.
We might as well look for scientific evidence that this bit of cut fabric, which appears to be hers, is actually from her dress.
Breaking into her cabin isn't the most sound idea, especially as it's a crime scene.
Which makes it all the more appealing.
He stood and offered a hand.
Let's get on with it. I'm sure the captain will come looking for you soon enough.
That was hardly a yes.
True, but it definitely wasn't a no either.
One corner of his mouth lifted.
I know you're as hungry to solve this as I am, Miss Wadsworth. I've started receiving complaints from patrons that aren't very promising for the Moonlight Carnival's future. Now, will you help me break into her chambers or not? As you said, she's dead. I doubt she'll mind our investigating.
I pointed half-heartedly at the stage. What about the milk can act?
You'll simply have to wait until tomorrow night and experience it with the rest of the passengers.
He held his hand out again.
Ready for some mild criminal activity?
I most certainly was not. With a sinking feeling dragging me down, I stood and followed the illusionist to the empty chamber of the murdered woman, already regretting my foolishness. 22. Cake and Masks. Promenade. RMS Etruria. 5 January. 1889. We exited onto the promenade deck, discovering a different type of chaos from the one we'd walked through only half an hour before. Like a swarm of ants, the crew and performers disassembled tents, folding striped canvas of black, white, and silver, packing it away for another moonlit revelry. Gone were the passengers indulging in all manner of wickedness beyond candy and treats. Scantily clad stilt walkers no longer danced like ghostly snakes in baskets, swaying to the rhythm of both the sea and seductive music. Clowns and fancy ladies smeared their waxy makeup until it looked like torn flesh over their own skin. However, no matter how tired and bedraggled the performers appeared, none of them had removed their masks. Why do they all keep their masks on after the show? Mephistopheles jerked his chin forward.
They earn $20 a week plus cake with one stipulation. They are never to be seen unmasked. Ever.
All you offer to feed them is cake? I raised a brow. And they agree to such things?
Hardly.
He snorted.
It means food is included in their wage.
I frowned at the carnival jargon and stipulation. There were an awful lot of rules for a band of people who wished to live without them.
You don't hold Harry Houdini to the mask clause, I pointed out. Doesn't that cause internal strife? I should think the rules ought to apply to everyone, or none at all.
With a nod to detour around the opposite side of the ship, the ringmaster guided me forward, along the empty starboard deck. Here we were alone with the creaking of rope and slumbering passengers. I tried not to shudder as the wind snapped at my collar, violent and threatening as any disturbed beast.
Harry is different, Mephistopheles finally said. He's going to be a legend one day, mark my words. A man like him already wears a mask. He's creating himself from the ashes of what he once was. Why make him wear a disguise when he becomes a new person each night, shedding a bit more of the old Harry?
Who is the old Harry?
I didn't truly expect an answer, but Mephistopheles was full of surprises.
He's a Hungarian immigrant, but you know where he tells people he's from?
Appleton, Wisconsin.
Harry's got so many invisible masks, a physical one would never be as authentic.
Is Harry even his real name? I asked, jesting.
Nope, it's Erich.
Erich?
Erich Weiss, if that's even true. No one but his mother can really be sure.
He counted off the cabins and slowed.
Here we are.
We halted outside a cabin 2 doors down from the stern of the ship. Remembering Uncle's insistence that murderers often revisit their crime scenes, I spun in place, taking in the surrounding area. Across from us, there was the railing and endless sea. On either side of the cabin, rowboats were mounted on the wall, like prized animal specimens. There wasn't much in the way of hiding places, so I wondered how her body had been removed.
How do you know which cabin is Miss Crenshaw's? I asked, suddenly. He hadn't been present when we'd investigated her room. Have you been here before? How did you recognize that scrap belonged to her dress?
Another thought crashed into me, and I narrowed my eyes.
Were you lovers?
Is that jealousy I detect? There's plenty of me for everyone, Miss Wadsworth. Though if you'd like to be my one and only, we might need to address the Cresswell situation. Once I've committed myself, I do not enjoy sharing.
I didn't deign to respond to such idiocy, though it did add another layer to the mystery of Miss Crenshaw's last hours. If she'd been with the ringmaster, might someone have been watching his movements? It made me think of Cassie again. Had she been jealous of his late-night escapades? Or did her husband follow him here, hoping to set him up for the crimes? Mephistopheles patted down the front of his waistcoat, frowning. He turned out his pockets, felt along the rim of his top hat, and then bent down to fumble around the soles of his boots.
Just another moment.
Honestly?
I asked, rolling my eyes skyward once I figured out what he was searching for.
How do you, of all people, not have a lockpick?
Do I look like Houdini to you?
He bristled.
He's the king of cuffs.
Obviously, else we'd be inside investigating by now instead of dawdling.
I removed one of my hat pins and nudged the ringmaster out of the way with my hip. He whistled in appreciation when I stuck the pin into the lock, jiggling it around until I heard the faint sound of tumblers clicking. Houdini wasn't the only one blessed with that skill. Perhaps if I did run off with the circus, I might practice and call myself the Queen of Cuffs. Saying a silent thank you to my father for the trick, I took one quick breath and pushed the door open.
Look who's a wonder worker now, I called over my shoulder. Perhaps I'll assist Mr. Houdini with his next daring escape.
How?
I swept into the cabin and stopped short. Though the cabin was unlit, moonlight spilled from the open doorway across the threshold, and I was able to make out a silhouette, sitting upright in the bed.
Either someone had stacked their pillows into a human shape, or we'd broken into an occupied room by mistake.
Mephistopheles bumped into me and cursed.
We ought to close the door. Good idea. It's a bit drafty otherwise, the silhouette said, then unfolded itself to a standing position. Perhaps you ought to lock it too. Wouldn't want to give anyone the wrong impression of what you're both doing here. Unchaperoned. After midnight? Doesn't look very good.
It had taken a few seconds to register, but the voice was not at all who I'd expected it might be.
Thomas!
My heart nearly leapt from my chest in its haste to escape this dreadful situation. What in the name of the Queen are you doing sitting here in the dark?
In answer, a light flared to life on a bedside table. Thomas held his lantern up and motioned to the room. It was perfectly intact, not a thing out of place. Corners of the bedsheets were pulled taut, the vanity carefully arranged with jewels and makeup. All seemed perfectly ordinary, with the exception of the three of us. Someone had obviously cleaned up the room since the last time we'd been here. I opened my mouth, but words failed. His behavior was always somewhat peculiar. However, this was strange even by his standards.
Sometimes I find it helps to place myself in the victim's last known location. If I sit quietly, I can recreate a scene.
Thomas cocked his head.
What exactly brings you both here? Did you discover something about Miss Crenshaw, or...
His tone was composed and cordial enough, but the flash of whatever that was in his expression immediately set my teeth on edge.
We were out for a romantic stroll and decided to cap off the evening with a visit to a dead woman's room. Stolen kisses around rotting carcasses are all the rage. I'm surprised you haven't given it a go yourself.
Before he schooled his features, I saw the hurt in his expression.
Honestly, what sort of question is that, Cresswell?
Thomas drew back so suddenly, I forgot my ire. He crinkled his nose.
What in God's name is that foul scent? He asked. It's awful.
He swatted the air in front of his nose.
Putrid even.
What?
I leaned forward, annoyance forgotten. Last time we'd smelled something terrible, it was back at the academy, and the discovery of a decomposing body had been close behind. I shoved that memory away, not wanting to think about the bats in that wretched chamber. I sniffed around, expecting the worst.
I don't smell anything unusual.
Oh, never mind. Thomas leaned back. It's simply your attitude, Miss Wadsworth. It stinks.
Mephistopheles actually bent over, wheezing with laughter, and I flashed him a glare that promised sudden death should he utter one more sound. He straightened and slowly backed away, hands up in surrender, though his chest shook with suppressed laughter.
Well now, this has taken quite a dramatic turn.
Mephistopheles pulled out his pocket watch, as if he was only now remembering an appointment with Satan.
Miss Wadsworth?
I glanced at the ringmaster as he strode toward the door and wrenched it open.
Truth is poison. Beware how much you ingest at once.
Would you cease with the fortune-telling advice already?
Be even more careful with how much you dispense.
He looked pointedly at Thomas, ignoring my jibe.
Good evening to you both.
23. Deductions and Deceit. Miss Crenshaw's Cabin, RMS Etruria, 5 January, 1889.
I cringed. The ringmaster certainly hadn't done me any favors by uttering that as a parting gift. Once the door clicked shut, Thomas sat back on the bed, the tension seeming to go out of him at once.
It was a simple question, Wadsworth, not an accusation. I've said it before. I will always respect your wishes on whomever you choose to spend your time or your life with.
I sighed. I understand why you're upset, I do. And I believe you're entitled to being angry.
I'm not angry.
His response came a little too quickly for it to be the truth. I let it go. It was something we could address once we made it to America. Another person is dead, Thomas. Our work must come first.
Technically, we don't know that he's dead. Perhaps his arm was properly amputated.
He tapped his fingers along his thighs, drawing my attention.
Until we examine the limb in detail, we cannot be sure he's not alive somewhere.
Do you truly believe that? I asked. If his arm hadn't been amputated properly, he'd have bled out.
It's unlikely he's living, given the three other murders, but it remains possible.
He ticked off reasons like numbers to add up or subtract.
We're aboard a ship with a traveling carnival. The engineering equipment they have is dangerous. He might have been trying to operate something and mangled his arm.
Perhaps whoever had been showing him a demonstration panicked. The ship itself has any number of places where a person might be injured. Do I believe any of those to be the actual events that occurred?
He shook his head.
Unfortunately, I do not, which is why I'm trying to piece the puzzle together. I believe this is the scene of the first actual murder. Logically, first crimes ought to hold the potential for the most mistakes made. It's where a murderer puts his dark fantasies into practice, though it rarely goes as planned. I'm hoping to find a clue to how this all began.
In the dark?
I'd just sneaked in myself. I heard someone coming and shut off the lights.
He narrowed his eyes.
You thought I was sitting here in the dark, staring at a wall? Is that why you appeared so surprised?
He gave me a dry look.
That's a bit eccentric, even for me.
Thomas, we weren't...
Please.
He patted the bed next to him, no trace of impropriety on his face.
Let's sit here a moment. There's something I've been meaning to...
He shifted uncomfortably.
Would you still like me to walk you through my method?
I had an inkling he'd changed his mind halfway through his sentence, but didn't press the issue. What he was offering now was an olive branch, an extension of peace for both of us to move past the things that didn't matter to the case. I walked to the bed and sat beside him. I'd enjoy that very much. Tell me, how does Mr. Thomas James Doring Cresswell apply his deductions to a scene such as this?
The incredibly handsome and talented Thomas James Doring Cresswell, you mean?
A faint smile ghosted across his face.
Start with obvious scenarios. Basic truths. What do we already know about the scene?
Well, I started, trying to recall the room as it had been. There were two champagne flutes, a half-eaten cake, and a discarded dress. The poisonous berries weren't found, so they must have been eaten before the cake.
Thomas nodded. And yet, I'm beginning to wonder if that's what actually killed her, or if they had only rendered her incapable of fighting someone off. Which might mean
there was more than one person involved. My pulse sped up with this theory. It was another strong indication that, perhaps, a husband and wife team had been working together to commit these acts. But then, Mephistopheles claimed to have spent time with her before the ship left. Someone sent him pieces of her cut dress. Thomas considered this. If I expected to read any emotions on his face after learning of the ringmaster's prowling, I was sorely disappointed. He was as cold and analytical as ever.
He might be lying. There's a strong possibility that he cut pieces of the dress himself, hoping to use it as sleight of hand.
But what would be the point? I asked, unconvinced. Wouldn't it only throw suspicion on him? He just as easily could have pretended to not know her or have been in her room. Who would have known?
Secrets never stay buried for long. Someone could have seen him and he might be covering for that potential.
I sighed, hoping his personal dislike of the ringmaster didn't interfere with his normal deductions. We sat in silence, each mulling over our thoughts. Finally, I broke the quiet. All right, let's start somewhere else. Say Mephistopheles did simply come over, have some champagne, and they... I blushed, not wanting to go into detail of what might have transpired after that drink. Then he left. Maybe someone had the cake and berries sent to her, pretending it was a token of love from him. There was only one plate and one fork. Then, after enough time had gone by and she'd gotten ill, the murderer made his move.
Interesting.
A spark of intrigue lit in Thomas's gaze.
Where would the point of entry be for the potential murderer?
That's quite easy, I said, motioning in front of us. The door. It's the only way in or out of this room.
Precisely. We ought to check it for any pry marks or...
He went rigid.
Look.
I stared toward the closed door. At first I didn't see anything at all. Then I squinted. Tiny spots of blood arced over the back of it.
That's an odd pattern, don't you think?
In two long strides, Thomas was examining the door with me right behind him. He rubbed his chin, probably to keep himself from touching potential evidence. His eyes darted over everything, calculating and deducing in ways I wished to bear witness to from the inside.
Let's play-act a murder, Wadsworth.
Despite the dire circumstances and the horrid story the blood splatter told, I smiled, and Thomas did the same. Perhaps we were both as devilish as the performers of the Moonlight Carnival. I'll play the part of the victim, I said. You're a much better murderer.
True.
He opened the door and stepped outside.
I haven't been caught yet.
Heathen. I rolled my eyes, but shut the door after him, waiting. A moment later he knocked, and I pushed all distracting thoughts aside. It wasn't hard to imagine how Miss Crenshaw felt as a soft knock came at her private chambers. Had the effects of the poison already begun? Did she stumble to the door, hoping to find help? Heart racing as quick as a mouse, I cracked the door. Had she been expecting her visitor, or was it a surprise caller? That would likely remain a mystery. Thomas stood with his top hat tilted forward, casting his sharp features in shadow. Even though I knew it was him, a shudder crept along my spine. He lifted his head, but I couldn't make out his eyes. This part of the promenade was exceptionally dark, even with the moon near full capacity. Listen, I whispered. Waves lapped at the hull, the noise rhythmic and dulling. Steam churned and hissed from one of the nearby funnels. White noise. It might have assisted with covering up the muffled sounds of a struggle, should anyone have been awake in neighboring cabins.
I imagine she must have known her attacker, he said, running his hands along the doorframe. There are no scratches or marks outside the door to prove it's been pried open.
I agree. Or she might have been too sick to refuse any assistance. I opened the door wider, granting him entry. Once he'd stepped back inside, I remained close, studying the blood splatter. There were only a few inches between us, and I could feel the heat of his body. I wondered if Miss Crenshaw had felt the same way before she'd been attacked. Did she stand as close to her murderer? Did she feel the warmth of him before he'd struck that fatal blow? There's no sign of a struggle in here either, I continued. So the attack must have happened shortly after she'd let the person in.
Thomas nodded. Her ring was still on her finger, so it wasn't a theft. And if I recall correctly, though it was only a brief inspection, there weren't any defensive wounds on her hands, aside from the cuts she made while clenching them. Why might that be?
I thought on it a moment, staring directly at Thomas's chest as an idea unfurled in my mind. Because, as you said, he struck her almost as quickly as she'd invited him in. If she was ill, her reflexes wouldn't have been quick enough to react. For once, I knew what Thomas experienced while he transported himself during our forensic cases. Instead of being prey, I became predator. My own darkness glittered like the eyes of a starving mutt at a feast, and I didn't try to stop or control its every ravenous whim. It was both glorious and terrifying, knowing how the mind of a murderer worked, what it desired, and how it felt to hold someone's life in your hands. Sure and steady as my scalpel, I had the power to choose how to end it all with a swift flick of my blade. How to end him. Power was as heady and intoxicating a feeling as the champagne Thomas and I had drunk together at the Christmas ball a fortnight ago. One teeny movement, and I decided his fate. Thomas's destiny was no longer written in the stars, or by any god the heavens might possess. It was my judgment to make. I was neither merciful nor kind. I was justice, and my blade was cold and swift. I clutched that persona, forcing it to lend knowledge I could use to our benefit. I grabbed Thomas and swung him around, making him the victim and me the murderer now. I'm sorry, Cresswell, I whispered, but this is going to hurt. Before he could protest, I jabbed him twice in the chest in rapid succession.
I didn't feel as sorry as I'd pictured. More worrisome was the hollow joy spreading like darkness through my core. I was a gifted forensic student, but I was an even more talented murderess. All I needed to do was surrender to that undulating dark, get swept up and away in its vicious pull. As I'd imagined, his hands automatically shot up to his wound. I held my pretend knife at the ready, watching him press his hands to his chest, where I imagined a bruise was forming. In a matter of 30 seconds, I'd incapacitated him. If Miss Crenshaw had been struck with a knife, she'd be easy to handle from there. I couldn't recall any stab wounds. But then again, her post-mortem was inconclusive because of how badly she'd been burned. Which might be another reason, aside from theatrics, that her corpse had been set ablaze. Unblinking, I noted every detail as Thomas staggered back. He did not raise his hands to ward off my attack because he was too busy trying to stop the flow of blood. Miss Crenshaw's lack of defensive wounds thus far were the same. I lifted my fist and Thomas pivoted away, avoiding the next strike. If he were truly bleeding, it would have sprayed in an arc across the door, exactly like the evidence left there. That's it! I figured it out! I nearly jumped in place. Thomas rubbed his chest, eyes fastened to my improvised weapon. I stopped making a fist and tenderly reached over and held a hand to his heart, biting my lip at his grimace. I truly am sorry for striking you. I got a bit carried away in the moment. Does it hurt?
Not much. You may feel free to put your hands on me any time you please.
He winked, then winced,
though I'd prefer the touch to be a bit more gentle in the future.
Noted. I led him back toward the bed, where he flopped down. While it doesn't lessen the bruise, I do believe I figured out how the blood splatter was caused. The arc and slight smear are indicative of a chest wound. She would have spun slowly. Maybe she even fell against the wall a moment after clutching her chest. From there, I'm not sure what. But the blood pattern would arc as she turned, then smear if she stumbled against the wall. That much I know for certain. It's exactly what you did. It's not too much to assume Miss Crenshaw was struck with a knife. Thomas offered me the sort of appraising look that set my blood aflame. There was no greater feeling than being admired for my brain.
Which means there is no doubt that whoever committed this act meant to dispatch her. She'd been targeted. But why?
I wonder if it's... Look. I picked up a playing card that had fallen between the nightstand and bed, holding it up. 6 of diamonds. He took the card and flipped it over, carefully inspecting each inch of it. He handed it to me, frowning.
Perhaps the cards are literal calling cards.
I stared at the intricate design on the back, a raven with iridescent wings opened against a full moon, and thorns edged in silver around the rim. I traced the double eights near the bottom. Or maybe it just means this is all part of a larger game. One that's the ultimate form of sleight of hand. 24. Dissection of the limb. Temporary Laboratory, RMS Etruria, 5 January, 1889. Uncle peered through a magnifying glass, his nose mere inches away from the severed limb. I knew he remained angry with me over being caught alone with the shirtless ringmaster. But he required my assistance, and nothing else mattered once forensics were involved. Thank goodness for small blessings. Thomas grabbed the journal he'd set down while donning an apron and resumed his note-taking. I couldn't shake a twinge of sickness when I thought of other notebooks he'd packed along for the journey, some of which contained notes written from Jack the Ripper. I was unready to read in great detail about his crimes, and Thomas kept whatever mysteries he uncovered there to himself. At least for now. I had a feeling we'd need to talk about them soon.
The toothed forceps, Audrey Rose.
Uncle held out his hand, palm up, waiting.
Quickly now.
Yes, Uncle. I gathered the medical instruments needed for this dissection. Toothed forceps, scalpel, scissors, Hagedorn needle, string, and carried a silver tray over. Here. I swiftly wiped down the forceps with carbolic acid, handing them over to my uncle with efficiency. He grunted, not quite a thank you, but not weighted silence either. I watched him peel back bits of skin near where the elbow should have been, had it not been either cut or bitten off at that joint. Flesh hung in thin strips, tattered like an old gown left to moulder in a forgotten trunk. I rolled my shoulders, allowing the coolness of a scientist to settle over me. I would neither be disgusted nor feel softness. Neither of those emotions would save the victim from his fate. Determination and a hardened heart would bring justice, though. Uncle waved me closer, brows creased. He pried away a bit of torn flesh, exposing a familiar streak of off-white.
"Do you see the radius and ulna?" he asked.
I nodded, doing my best to focus only on those bones, and not the outer layer of graying meat surrounding them.
"While I peel back the muscle and tendons, describe what you see. Thomas, write down everything."
I bent until I was eye level with the limb, taking note of every detail. "There's splintering on the radius, but not on the ulna. On that, I see a nick in the bone. I'd wager it was made by a sharp instrument, likely a knife."
I swallowed my revulsion down.
"Splintering on the radius is most probably from the lion gnawing on the arm, and is unrelated to how the limb was severed."
"Good, very good."
Uncle pushed the skin back farther, hands steady.
"Were the wounds received post-mortem?"
I bit my lip. There were no marks on the skin of the forearm, no signs of trauma sustained during a struggle. I glanced up at Thomas, but he was focused on writing. I took a moment to appreciate that I was trusted by both of these men to locate forensic information on my own. Pulling my shoulders back and standing taller, I allowed confidence to fall about me like a cloak. "I believe the wounds were created post-mortem. They're most likely the result of the limb being severed." I pointed to the rest of the arm. "There are no abrasions or cuts, both of which would be present in a victim who was fighting back against a knife attack." Uncle turned the arm over, inspecting the underside of it. The flesh was paler than most cadavers, having lost so much blood, but not as pale as the more recent bodies I'd studied at the academy. Post-mortem lividity was present, the slight staining visible on the underside, where blood had pooled due to gravity. It indicated where a body had lain after death, and could not be altered after several hours, even when the cadaver was moved into a new position. Except in a strange case where all the blood had been removed, there had been no staining then. "Lividity is present," I added, noting the flash of surprise and pride in my uncle's eyes. I'd learned much at the academy. "I imagine he was already positioned on his back, lying down, when the murderer began hacking him apart. The evidence aligns with it."
"So it does."
Uncle sounded pleased as he inspected the lividity on his own, his former annoyance with me erased. We were an odd family. Thomas crinkled his nose.
"Even without arterial splattering, wherever this dismemberment took place must be saturated in blood. I'm not sure anyone would be able to clean all of it away without leaving evidence behind." "Very good point."
Uncle picked up a scalpel, using it to neatly cut away more of the mauled flesh. I swallowed hard. No matter how often I witnessed it, it was always a gruesome sight to behold. Carving flesh as if it were fine meat was repulsive.
"The bones were cut cleanly," Uncle continued. "Whoever removed this limb didn't use a saw or serrated blade."
He set the scalpel down, then walked over to the water basin. Neither Thomas nor I speculated while he washed his hands with carbolic soap. Once he finished, he turned to us, face drawn. I had an inkling it wasn't the late hour that made him weary.
"We need to concentrate on those who have access to strong, smooth blades. Kitchen staff, crew members."
Dread, heavy and unyielding, clunked into my empty stomach. "Or most likely, based on their skill and proximity to such weapons, carnival performers who specialize in blades." For a moment, no one spoke. There were a few obvious choices, though any one of the performers could stab someone.
You believe Jian did this?
Thomas dragged his attention away from the severed limb.
A wonder it didn't make it as part of the stage act. Tossing melons, pineapples, severed arms. Seems quite fitting for the other theatrical murders.
I believe he's someone we should at least consider, I said, ignoring his forced light commentary. We also need to thoroughly research who else has access to his blades once the show is over. Does he lock them in a trunk at night, or sleep on them? I lifted a shoulder. If they're locked away, then we could expand the search to those who are gifted with picking locks. I met both Uncle's and Thomas's gazes, seeing their worry mixed with my own. It was all speculation, of course. But if those swords were locked up, then there was only one young man on this ship who'd crowned himself king of escaping any cuff and picking any lock. I ignored the scuttle of fear as it moved across my spine. If Harry Houdini kept reinventing himself, wearing new invisible masks in each city, I supposed it was possible that he wore the most convincing disguise of all. An innocent man, incapable of committing such heinous acts of murder. Maybe Cassie and her husband weren't exacting revenge. Perhaps it had been someone obvious, yet not. If Houdini had a secret lover in America Liza didn't know of, there was no telling how many other secrets he had.
Let's go make some inquiries, Thomas said, closing his notebook. We'll start with Mephistopheles and Jian.
If we march into the performer's practice area now, demanding to question everyone, we're going to be met with a wall as dense as London fog, I said.
What method do you suggest, then?
Uncle asked. He'd not seen the growth I'd undergone while studying at the academy until this moment. I felt much more confident in exerting my hypothesis, less worried about being wrong, or mocked if I was. Thomas had once told me he wasn't afraid of being proven wrong. He only feared not trying. We will simply need to craft illusions of our own, I said, already well into my own deceit act. We'll use misdirection with our inquiries. Let them be suspicious of something unrelated. If they make their livings using that art form, there's no reason why we can't use that very method ourselves. A slow, wicked grin lifted the edges of Thomas's mouth.
If they're the Moonlight Carnival, we ought to come up with our own fancy name. Marauders of Truth. Maidens of Mischief. Well, he amended, taking in my uncle's heavy sigh, that doesn't necessarily apply to all of us. I'll keep thinking up names.
While you occupy yourself with that monumentally important task, I said, Liza invited Anisha for tea in the morning. I'll see what I can uncover about her and anyone who might be a secret swordsman. I chanced to look at my uncle and smiled. Let's plan on going over our findings before supper tomorrow. Thomas pulled his pocket watch out, clicking it open with a grand flourish.
That gives us 13 hours to sleep, infiltrate their ranks, create a bit of smoke to distract them, come up with our group name, and be dressed in our supper best.
He ran a hand through his carefully styled brown locks.
Thank goodness it doesn't take much to make this. He swept his arm across his person, blindingly handsome. Unlike Mephistopheles. Seems the two of you learned extra skills while at the academy.
Uncle took the limb on its tray and placed it in a refrigerated box loaned to us by the captain.
Though I'm not sure how sarcasm and banter will benefit this case. We need to focus on identifying who this limb belongs to. It's called charm, Professor, and I do believe it'll get us far.
Thomas inhaled deeply, eyes dancing with mirth.
No one can resist a well-timed quip.
Uncle turned from the refrigerated box, looking less than amused.
Both of you are dismissed. Go to bed, then enchant or annoy information out of the carnival performers in the morning.
He waved off Thomas's next remark.
Try not to aggravate any of them too much. A little of your charm goes a long way.
No one told me to be careful, which I took as a positive sign. An idea was forming that I wasn't sure either of them would like. But it was always preferable to beg for forgiveness after the fact than ask for permission beforehand. I just hoped Thomas wouldn't be too upset about me doing this next act. On my own. Morning arrived much sooner than night had left, and I awoke to the sound of knocking at my door. I scrubbed at my face and found a tarot card stuck to my cheek. I must have fallen asleep on the deck. Liza rolled her eyes, but said nothing as she shoved me toward my trunk.
"One moment,"
she called out, purchasing a bit of time for me to get ready. I cursed in the most impolite of ways, running around to pull on a decent yet simple receiving dress. A few minutes later, my cousin opened the door with a grand flourish.
"I'd like to introduce Anisha, also known as the Ace of Wands," Liza said graciously. "This is my cousin, Audrey Rose."
We curtsied to each other and arranged ourselves on chairs and stools, while a maid entered and set down a samovar and a tray filled with breakfast sweets. I filled my cup, wincing as the first sip scorched my tongue. I peeked over at Liza. Of course, being the perennial hostess, she'd been up early, calling for refreshments. I could embrace her for her attention to detail in times like this. Anisha, the fire-swallowing goddess, was nearly unrecognizable out of her ice-inspired costume. Instead of the thickly braided silver wig, her hair was chin-length bluish-black that hung in a smooth sheet. Her skin, now that it wasn't painted ice blue white, was a shade between golden brown and fawn. She gave up trying to balance her teacup on her lap and sat cross-legged on the floor where Liza was already seated. I watched, wide-eyed, as she sipped the same tea that had scalded my tongue and offered an amused grin. "After swallowing fire every night, tea never seems as hot," she said with a wink. At my unladylike snicker, Liza lovingly smiled before sipping from her own cup. Not wanting to be rude, I joined them on the thick carpet. "I dare say that's true." I set my teacup and saucer down, watching the steam rise, like a snake striking the air. "How did you first start eating flames? I cannot imagine attempting it for the first time. You're very brave."
"Most would say very foolish," she said, narrowing her eyes.
I offered my most innocent, benign expression. Liza huffed in exasperation, but didn't chide me for my inquisitiveness as her mother would have done. She was well-versed in sensing a scheme and knew I was up to something. Instead of commenting, she passed a tray of biscuits around, probably hoping the sweets would distract from my social awkwardness. Anisha snatched a biscuit, eyeing up bits of chocolate before responding to my question. "A pair of wonder workers, fakirs, taught me how to swallow flames. They said my name, which roughly means one whose life knows no darkness, meant I was born to wield fire." She snorted. "Flames were mine to command, to swallow whole." She lifted her tea back up, taking a long pull. "I was very young and very impressionable when they first lured me away from my home, fooled by the promise of riches. I am embarrassed that I fell for their sweet words. Once I agreed to leave, they dropped me off, took their coin, and left to find another person for another carnival."
"They were the ones who ought to be ashamed. You did nothing wrong."
Liza reached over and clutched the girl's hand, reminding me how talented she was at sensing what people needed and innately offering support. "Liza's right," I added. "Tricking you into joining a traveling troupe was a terrible thing for them to do." Anisha lifted a shoulder and tore off chunks of her biscuit. "They brought me here, and life has been good with the Moonlight Carnival. I have money, food, friends. It turned out to be all right."
"Mephistopheles was the one who did that to you?"
I asked, trying very hard not to have my china rattle as my hands shook.
"He tricked you from your home and family."
"He..." Anisha briefly dropped her gaze to her lap before continuing. "He hires people in countries he visits to seek out talent. Anyone who's been through a difficult time, he invites into the carnival and trains. The choice is ultimately ours to make, but he makes the deal hard to pass on."
"So is everyone in the carnival from a different country?"
"Mostly. Gian is from China, Sebastian, Spain, Andreas is from Bavaria, Cassie is French, though she speaks in an English accent, and I'm from India."
You mentioned he seeks those who've had a difficult time. What exactly do you mean?
I asked, though Liza gave me a look that said I was an idiot for prying.
We all have reasons to leave our lives behind.
She inhaled deeply.
Now, would you like to know how I swallow flames?
That's what everyone wants, though most don't really want the magic or illusion destroyed.
I studied her for another moment, knowing the inquiry into her past and the carnival was now over. I didn't quite know what to make of Mephistopheles. He didn't necessarily save anyone, but I couldn't quite say he'd harmed or tricked them either. Though maybe they didn't see it that way. Perhaps resentment started as a small cut and became infected over time. Perhaps someone wanted the Moonlight Carnival to be destroyed as revenge for taking them from their homes.
Well, Anisha asked, would you like to know?
Please, I said, shaking thoughts of potential motives away. How do you swallow the flames and not get burnt? She pushed herself up, gracefully trekking across the floor as if it were the stage. I wondered if the performers ever dropped their acts, or if their entire existence was given over to their craft. Observe this taper. Anisha removed a candlestick from its holder on my nightstand, lit the end, then turned it nearly upside down. Wax beaded, slipping toward the floor. Where does the flame go when I hold it this way? Understanding dawned. Away from the bottom, or, I added, if it were during one of your performances, the flame would be reaching away from your mouth.
See? Anisha smiled warmly. You're a natural.
She cupped her palm around the candle, snuffing the flame out, and set it back in its holder.
Same principle is applied when I swallow the fire. All I'm doing is removing the heat from my face, then carefully exhaling as I put the torch in my mouth. Most living things need oxygen to breathe, even fire. Deny it of that, and it dies like anything would.
She folded herself back on the floor where Liza and I remained seated.
The real trick is using the laws of physics. Like that scientist, Newton? Mephistopheles taught me all about him. He was right. It helped hone my performances.
Her voice changed a bit while speaking of the ringmaster. Admiration, tinged with a bit of longing. I wondered if there was a person aboard this ship who hadn't fallen under his spell. Well, besides Thomas.
Does Mephistopheles help all the performers? I asked, eyes fixed on my teacup.
I imagined he charmed young men and women in each city or town they'd passed through. If she'd harbored feelings for him that he didn't return, perhaps it might prove to be motive. That, mixed with resentment, would be a powerful reason.
He seems as smart as he is handsome.
Liza shot me an incredulous look, but pressed her lips together. Apparently I was in for a good scolding once we were alone. Despite what everyone in London thought of Thomas and his odd behavior, Liza liked him very much, and my interest in the ringmaster was not right in her romantic book, no matter what my reasons were.
Mephistopheles is... Anisha seemed to formulate her answer carefully.
He's very gifted at what he does. Many benefit from the lessons he chooses to give. We're all very grateful to him.
I sat back, fiddling with the buttons on the side of my gloves.
Did he give such lessons to Cassie?
Liza suddenly found her tea infinitely intriguing, and Anisha seemed at a loss for words.
Would you like to see him, as no one aside from his performers do? Anisha finally asked.
I hoped she didn't mean naked as the day he'd come into this world.
I nodded slowly. Meet me on the second class promenade in 1 hour. Then you'll understand why we'd all do anything for him.
25. Gears and Gadgets. Audrey Rose's Cabin, RMS Etruria, 6th January, 1889.
Would you care to explain what that was about, cousin?
Liza's cheeks were splotchy pink, a great indication of how upset she was. Any moment steam might shoot from her ears. I swallowed nervous laughter, knowing she wouldn't appreciate being told she was her mother's daughter in this moment.
I am not one to judge, but you seem awfully intrigued by Mephistopheles.
she continued. Emphasis on awful. What about Mr. Cresswell? Have your feelings for him changed that quickly? Your letters from the Academy seemed to indicate some grand romance, though you were upset with him at the time.
She inspected me with sharp-eyed focus, similar to how I'd dissect a specimen with my scalpel.
Has Mephistopheles won your heart so easily? I thought you would see through his lies.
I pinched the skin between my thumb and forefinger, using it to focus.
Where is the scandal in speaking with someone? I asked. It's not as if Mephistopheles has declared himself to me. Perhaps I simply enjoy hearing about his use of science. I've always been intrigued with engineering. We're not so different, you know.
Is that what he's told you?
Liza gave me a long, measured look.
That you're both similar in nature? That you belong together?
Her tone was drenched in disapproval, though I could see the concern in her face.
What if he has said those things?
I lifted my chin, doing my best imitation of being indignant and hating myself a little more for it. How many lies would I be forced to tell before this charade was over?
It's true. We both love science. His is just a bit more flashy. There's much I could learn from him, though. Things that might help me figure out where, exactly, I belong.
Dissecting the dead is much less showy, she said dryly.
Maybe you should borrow one of his masks, or ask his costumer for a new autopsy gown. I'm sure he could sew something up that would restart any heart.
Where you belong is with Uncle and Thomas, solving crimes for those who could not do it on their own. Not dressed up and prancing around a stage in a different city each night, on the arm of a man who will always love the show more.
Don't be sour, cousin, I said, trying hard not to read too much into her last sentence. I simply enjoy learning how he engineers his tricks. He is quite... The machines and mechanisms he builds are incredible. If he would focus on creating medical tools...
I trailed off, suddenly not speaking any more half-truths. If Mephistopheles used his brain to craft machines used in surgeries, there were endless possibilities for healing. Liza searched my face for a moment, not quite convinced. I fought to keep my expression frozen into the mask I'd donned.
Be careful of giving your heart to men like that, she finally said, shoulders slumping.
Men like what?
I reached over and gripped her hand.
Scientists and engineers. Liars.
He's an illusionist, I said, not missing the venom she'd injected into that single word.
A wonder worker.
Exactly.
Liza took her hand from mine and crossed her arms.
A liar, in a fancy frock coat.
For a heart-grabbing moment, I feared that Mephistopheles had acted on our bargain against my wishes, leaving Liza an anonymous letter with information on Houdini. I swallowed hard, feeling the wall of lies crumble in on me. It was time to come clean about one secret.
Is everything all right between you and Harry?
Of course. Why wouldn't it be?
She examined my face, her lips turning down. There was something in her eyes, though. Something that indicated all wasn't as well as she'd like me to believe.
What is it? What aren't you telling me?
This was it. The moment I'd been dreading. Suddenly, looking into my cousin's pleading eyes, I couldn't bring myself to break her heart. She gripped my hand. If she was having doubts about Houdini, I needed to give her all the information I had. We made land in only one more day. Still, I couldn't seem to make myself take that last step.
Please, whatever it is, I need to know.
I dropped onto the bed, heart thudding slow enough to toll the hour of dread. Without saying a word, I reached over and removed the half-ruined letter from my nightstand. I gave it to Liza, keeping my eyes averted as she sank down beside me.
That lying scoundrel!
She crumpled the paper, voice trembling when she spoke.
I'll toss him overboard like the piece of rubbish he is! Where's my cloak?
Fearing her temper might lead her to such extremes, I gathered my courage and faced her.
Liza, you cannot confront him.
Are you mad? She cried. Of course I must confront him.
At least wait until we've reached port. There's already so much to contend with. Please, I beg of you, wait. It's only for one more day. And then, if you still wish to do so, I will help you toss him into the harbor. I swear it.
Liza marched in a circle around the room, shaking her head.
You want me to act as if nothing is wrong? Would you do the same thing if you were in my shoes?
I would do whatever needed to be done, I said truthfully, especially if it came down to putting an investigation first. Liza stared at me, and I couldn't quite pick out the emotions that shifted across her face.
Tell me this much. Where did you get the letter? Did Anisha give it to you?
Mephistopheles did. I haven't wanted to ruin your trip.
This wasn't simply a trip for me.
Her lips trembled.
He was supposed to be my future. I gave up so much.
She swallowed whatever she was about to say, her voice as hard as diamonds when she spoke next.
Never, ever give up yourself for someone else, Audrey Rose. The right person will want you just as you are. And if they don't?
She sniffed and shook her head.
Forget them. Tipping the scales too far in either direction is nothing but trouble. I gave up my home and family for kisses, playing cards, and empty promises of a future. Houdini is a liar, and I'm glad to be done with him. Liza, I wanted to tell you, I promise I will not say anything to him for now. I'll act as though everything is well. Heaven forbid the King of Cards have any distractions before his next stunt.
Liza purposely glanced at the clock on my nightstand.
You'd better hurry, or you'll be late for your meeting with Anisha and Mephistopheles. He's never alone for long. Harry often meets with him after breakfast, which will only give you a few minutes with him.
Here. She pulled out the stool by my vanity.
Sit, and I'll braid your hair.
I stared at my cousin a beat more, wanting to crack the wall she'd suddenly built around herself, but sat instead. She ran a silver-handled brush through my hair, twisting and pulling it into shape. I pretended not to notice the single tear that streaked down her cheek as she fastened tiny red buds into my hair, or the way her eyes purposely refused to meet mine in the looking glass. It seemed I wasn't the only member of my family keeping secrets on this voyage now. Ocean mist sprayed over the railing of the boat, forcing me to walk closer to the cabin side of the promenade to avoid catching a worse chill. With Liza's assistance, I'd changed into a more elaborate day dress, a long-sleeved deep burgundy velvet overlaid with delicate black lace. I'd added kidskin gloves and a dark cloak. I looked like a splatter of dried blood, which was quite fitting, considering what I was about to do. Sacrifice was messy business. What Liza hadn't seen me add was the leather belt fastened at my thigh and the scalpel I'd stuck in it. The weapon belt was a design I'd had crafted in Romania for myself, the best Christmas gift to date. My fingers brushed down the front of my bodice, comforted by the knowledge of my blade, though the plan formulating in my head was much less soothing. It was brash and risky, but the reward would outweigh the peril. I hoped. I hadn't had an opportunity to speak with Thomas, so I was depending on his ability to glean truth from subtle clues. Hopefully he wouldn't be hindered by Mephistopheles' jibes, and hopefully I wouldn't be distracted by how sick I felt over Liza's despair. A young couple passed by, their eyes darting around the deck as they clutched each other a bit too tightly. They were the first people I'd encountered, and their stroll did not appear to be as relaxing as they were attempting to make it. In fact, most of the ship felt too quiet. Passengers were taking more of their meals in their cabins, and only venturing out when absolutely necessary. A pretty prison was what this ship had become. I continued on, thoughts tumbling over one another. Out this far in the water, there were no gulls calling overhead, singing their own songs of woe. Instead, there were snippets of conversation that rolled down the wooden deck toward me, too muffled to make out. Women and men in less fine suits and dresses than those of first class, but still quite fashionable, peered out from their cabins as I made my way toward Anisha. My heart thumped against my chest in warning. but it was too late to turn back now. I was here, and the plan needed to unfold now.